Now here are Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker to discuss the fallout from Trump's travel ban.
Well, Mike, in between the Twitter attacks and the media last week, Trump displayed his triumphant side in declaring the Supreme Court decision last Monday a vindication of his travel ban. So let's talk about the Supreme Court decision and the curious aspect of it being a unanimous Supreme Court decision, what it says about the travel ban, and then we'll talk about some of the broader border politics in play.
Well, Jen, it was unanimous only in one sense, that they all agreed that they would partially uphold the travel ban. Three members dissented strongly. They thought the whole thing should be affirmed strongly.
The conservatives.
Yeah, absolutely. But the six members of the Supreme Court looked at the hardships the ban would create for the named plaintiffs in these cases, which were two men with family members who wanted to come to the U.S. from the affected countries, and the state of Hawaii, whose state university had admitted students from those countries. The court explained that this lower court order's barring enforcement of the ban reached much further than that because it applied to people living overseas who they said had no connection to the U.S. at all. But if you did have a legitimate connection, a bona fide family relationship, or an invitation from a college or an employer who wanted to hire you, then their constitutional rights were violated.
You know, it'd be interesting to do a little survey of people getting off airplanes from that country and a little checklist of bona fide criteria. I would suspect most of them meet some standard of bona fide. It's one of those ideological terms that implies some vetting that's not already in place. And of course, you cannot get through customs. You're asked, why are you here? Already a kind of extreme bar. So this does seem like much ado about nothing, but of course it is a part of a larger game.
So what is a bona fide reason to come? By the way, you're right about that, in that 90% of the people who are affected will be able to continue to come. It's not if only those people with no conceivable relationship or arguable reason who are banned from coming. And already it's a very steep hill to get a visa or to be allowed to come.
And to have the resources to get on a plane. And it's a different issue, people flying in from far away and the resources required to do that, than the border politics along
Absolutely.
The southern border, which we'll hopefully get to later. So what about the organizing potential, too, around this issue? Because there will be litigation, of course, as there are on many fronts. But, I mean, one issue is the enormous power the executive branch has around immigration politics. That's one issue.
Well, they always have. It's immigration exceptionalism. It's a part of the law that the courts have really deferred to the executive branch. That's colliding against the guarantees against racial and religious discrimination, which in a way prevailed in this decision. The conservatives said the decision is unworkable because there's going to be tons of litigation over just what is a bona fide reason. And of course, he's right. There will be the summer of litigation, because why can your grandfather not come? What if your grandfather raised you or had a significant part in your upbringing?
It's nuclear familialism that's given priority here rather than extended kin.
That's right. But the extended kin will be able to make a case, and they will be making cases all summer long until the case is finally argued next October.
But I think with the refugee politics, there's another ethic and ethos that is at stake. We need to emphasize that the social bonds are formed not just on the basis of next of kin or extended kin, but our larger obligations to one another. And that this is an area, too, where there's a hard limit that Trump has imposed arbitrarily have the number of refugees who can come in the country. There are battles now over how many of those refugees that are permitted will meet the criteria bona fide through their relationships with resettlement refugee organizations. That's one issue. But it seems like a larger issue is what are our obligations to one another beyond kin?
Those are defined in economic good times. People are generally indifferent to immigration. And that's when immigrants come in large numbers, in droves, because there are jobs, there are opportunities in the U.S.
And even policies that promote, like the Braceros program, that was during the 50s and 60s, right?
Where a blind eye is turned to what's, mm-hmm. what's happening. But when things are bad, that's when the fear of the other, the general fear itself becomes large part of people's lives, scapegoating of other people as blaming them for the downturn in their lives individually. In the 30s, there were Mexican shipped back to Mexico in boxcars, like Jews being sent to concentration camps from Arizona and all over the Southwest without anyone noticing. It was a revulsion against anyone different, anybody who was seen to be undercutting people's existences. But now we have a bifurcated economy. The West Coast is thriving. It's doing very well economically.
And that's California. That's part of the political picture in California that has a very large Latino population and a strong, I mean, you could overstate it, but sanctuary city movement. And some cities are predominantly Latino, as are their city councils. But Texas is more is kind of a mixed picture politically.
It is. It's the perfect
close
mixed
to
picture.
Half of Texas is Latino.
Yeah, and like Austin is part of the economic boom. It's got a big Apple branch there. It's entertainment center. It's got lots of high-tech stuff. All the parts of the economy that are doing well are present in Austin. Austin's a sanctuary city. But Texas has just passed the most repressive law about immigrants you can imagine, SB 4. And it bans, among other things, sanctuary cities. So there are blue cities throughout Texas, which are isolated in a sea of small declining villages and smaller cities that are doing badly. So the politics of Texas are the place where both these issues are colliding the loudest. Up and down this coast, the refugee movement in favor of refugees is articulate and pretty strong. But around the country, huge areas of the country are strongly supportive of everything Trump can do to keep out foreigners.
And indeed, the House last week passed with a vote of 228 to 195, the No Sanctuary for Criminals Act, playing on sanctuary. And let's talk about what's meant by criminality here in this act. And it clearly draws on the fear you're describing.
What it does is it turns anyone who's been deported and then who gets caught coming back into this country as a serious criminal. It's
right.
not just a matter of trying to evade borders. It becomes a serious crime. It's an effort to get this catch and release, quote unquote, theory gone, which is what has been in effect. The people are simply turned around and shipped back, but now they will be incarcerated. You wonder why private prison stock boomed when Trump was elected. This whole drift toward incarcerating people who have fled oppressive environments in Central America. There are teenagers who are confined indefinitely now in a series of prisons built along the borders owned by private companies that have a very difficult time being represented, finding someone to talk to about their status. And this the process of criminalizing and therefore justifying extended periods of confinement for people
for crossing the border.
For crossing the border a second time is part of this whole wave toward criminalizing and limiting and incarcerating. It's an extraordinary expansion of lockups.
And these are borders that long periods of our history were, and not even so far back, were places where people could go back and forth with ease.
That's true.
And then that those same passages become criminalized. So there's clearly a powerful resonance of this idea of borders, and a number of social scientists have talked about how society's undergoing change, destabilizing changes, become preoccupied with the borders of the body, particularly women's borders. I think abortion politics become part of that, the sanctity of the fetus, and also the nation's borders, kind of fortifying and defending borders. So what about the borders along the southern border, which evokes passages of people walking on foot, versus the borders of our airports? And you have a different kind of discourse around Muslims, which is more of a religiously inflected, oriented prejudice, versus Mexicans coming across the border. They are similar in a way, kind of paranoia about the other, but they're also different.
It has different forms. And the Muslims in this country are generally pretty well off. They're generally pretty conservative. It's not easy to get a plane ticket and get over here. They're very well educated for the most part. The Muslims,
and come from very different countries.
They come from very different countries.
Yeah.
Muslims in the ghettos of Paris and London have had to walk. They've struggled. They haven't been able to fly planes. They've been chased out of their native countries by bombs that we drop and that England has dropped. And there's a whole different social class.
The ones that end up on the shores of Italy versus flying into the U.S. to JFK.
Yeah. There's a tremendous dislocation throughout the Middle East. And Europe catches the brunt of it. We are barely touched by the repercussions of what we've done over there.
And yet you go to these Trump rallies, and there are these declarations against Sharia law. And it's like, that we're not going to allow that to be declared in this country. And it's like psychotic.
Whereas the
influx of Latino communities is real. But the threat is crazy. So it's different kinds of paranoia operating here.
Yeah, the truth is that people don't come up south of the border much now for economic reasons. They do to some extent, but nothing like, say, 10 years ago. But there are significant numbers of people fleeing horrible governments, like, for example, in Honduras, where a coup we engendered has led to Honduras becoming the murder capital of the world, patrolled in many parts by gangs formed originally in Los Angeles and here. But it's just a society that is the nearest thing to a failed state in the Western Hemisphere.
So there is some of that shutting out the horrors of the south of the border that have been generated by our government.
And lots of those kids, by kids I mean 12-year-olds and 13-year-olds who've walked and hitchhiked and made it up to the border and are now being incarcerated in private prisons.
Yeah. So, Mike, we'll continue to follow the border politics, and clearly the Supreme Court decision is just one moment in an ongoing series of tragedies, but also potential for resistance and organizing. So we'll carry on with this.
Good.
Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker talking about the Supreme Court decision last week and border politics.
Documentos, mírame a los ojos para que leas mi acento. Prohibido como la droga, ilegal como un nazi en una sinagoga. Contraindicado, clandestino, lo identificable, lo contamino. Más de 600 millones de personas gritando luz verde para invadir Arizona. No necesito diplomas, lo que aprendí lo viví y lo almaceno en mis neuronas. Las experiencias son mis talleres. La vida es un estudio desde que se nace hasta que se muere. Así crucé pa'l norte buscando buena vida, componente vacío de materia consumida. Dejé a mi abuela sola pa' besarle el culo a Ronald McDonald y tomar Coca-Cola.